The COVID-19 crisis has exacerbated the already existing deep structural problems of corporate and increasingly globalized food systems. A radical human rights-based and agroecological transformation of food systems is more urgent than ever. As the United Nations gears itself to hold the 2021 version of the UNFSS, the United Nations Food Systems Summit, activists and analysts are sounding the alarm that this year's event is not building on the legacy of past World Food Summits, which resulted in the creation of innovative, inclusive, and participatory global food governance mechanisms anchored in human rights, such as the reformed UN Committee on World Food Security, the CFS. This year's Food Systems Summit follows a strong multi-stakeholder approach, which puts on equal footing governments, corporations, other private sector actors, philanthropies, scientists, and NGOs. Critics argue that while the FSS organizers aim to create an illusion of inclusiveness, it remains unclear who is in control of taking decisions and by what procedures those decisions are made. Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast. I am your host, Sean Macheza. Our guest on the podcast today, Paula Gioia, is a peasant farmer, a beekeeper based in Germany. She works on a community farm and is part of the European coordination of La Via Campesina. La Via Campesina, or LVC, is an international movement bringing together millions of peasants, small and medium-sized farmers, landless people, rural women and youth, indigenous people, migrants, and agricultural workers from around the world. Built on a strong sense of unity and solidarity between these groups, it defends peasant agriculture and strongly opposes corporate-driven agriculture that destroys social relations and nature. La Via Campesina believes that this year's summit is opening up UN processes to the private sector. It is privileging the corporate elites, and the process behind it has been opaque, exclusive, and has ignored the autonomy of people's movements. What follows is a conversation I had with Paula, in which we discuss what kind of food regime is needed today, right now, and how we can bring it about. What are the main obstacles today to making fully real and accessible for everyone a genuine and meaningful human right to food? So, Paula, let's talk about food. You yourself are a farmer. You're involved in the process of bringing food to people's tables. I think when people think about food, most times, I think in particularly the developed world, people think of the supermarket as you just go in there and you get food and you prepare it and you put it on your table. But of course, we need to understand food in a much more complex way, in a way that encapsulates the entire process of bringing food to the table. Is the way we get food today a good way? What kind of food system actually do we want to have?
So I would say that what we are seeing today, and not only today, already since some decades, what we have been seeing is that food is turning more and more into a commodity, you know, while food should be actually seen as a human right. And within La Via Campesina, we are very, very clear that our food systems must urgently be transformed. Food is, as I said, a human right. And this is a human right which is also indivisible from other basic human rights, like the right to health, like the right to housing, to clean environments, and so on. Therefore, any transformation of our food regime, any decisions over food policy and governance must respond to these rights and needs that I just described. Mm-hmm. It means that the food system must be grounded in human rights. And this is not what we are seeing today. And the current ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, also the climate chaos in the world today, the alarming increasing of hunger, as we have just seen in the recently published SOFI report, the biodiversity losses we are facing, and all the other crises in the world today, they are all further evidence that our commitments to food sovereignty as Via Campesina and allied movements is actually the right path. While we have been rejecting the corporate takeover of food systems and food governance.
There's quite a lot there. Do you want to maybe break down what you mean when you talk about food sovereignty?
So food sovereignty is a vision and also a practice that was first announced and described by La Via Campesina 1996 during the World Food Summit in Rome. Mm-hmm. This year, we are actually celebrating 25 years of this peasant-led campaign to bring food sovereignty to a reality. You know? It means that we have been, for the last 25 years, working to provide healthy dieties, caring for healthy soils, healthy seeds. We have been practicing agroecology and so on. At the same time that we remain or continue to resist the capitalist model. Mm-hmm. So food sovereignty is the right of peoples to autonomously produce healthy, nutritious, and climatically and also culturally appropriate food using local resources and through agroecological means to address the local food needs of our communities. And since we launched it 25 years ago, I would say that the food sovereignty definition has expanded to reflect the interests of many other vulnerable and often also neglected constituencies in rural, but also in urban areas. And I would say that nowadays, food sovereignty is not only a concept, a practice, but it is also a movement embracing numerous constituencies from all regions in the world. So that's how I would respond to your question.
So we have all these people that are working together to bring about a food system that's different from what we currently have, right? Because from what I'm getting from what you're saying is that the food system as it currently exists definitely has a few flaws, things that are not working, that are standing against people being able to feed themselves, being able to achieve the human right to bring food to their tables, and not only to just bring food, but to bring the kind of food that they want to have culturally also, with all the other different aspects that go along with that. What have people been doing to sort of change this food system?
If we talk about transformation, I think it's very important to bring all these actors into the table, right? It's not possible to talk about transformation only, let's say, narrowing inclusion and intensifying corporate capture and destruction of nature, no? So this approach have already failed too many times. What we need in terms of transformation is actually to bring, for example, not only peasants working on the land, but also small-scale fisher communities, indigenous peoples, pastoralists, forest communities, agricultural workers, no migrant workers, but also urban poor, consumers from rural and also urban areas, because they are the heart of the food system, you know, and they have to be on the discussions. They have to be around this table.
And so, have they been around the table? Because I'm trying to imagine being a rural farmer somewhere in rural Kenya or Zimbabwe or somewhere in Cambodia, or have they been brought to the table?
I would say that since, 1996, the concept of food sovereignty has been presented to the world, let's say, during the World Food Summit in 1996, organized by FAO. And after that, there was a whole process, of democratization, let's say, of the spaces where food and agriculture were being discussed. And
so opening up the space to beyond just food experts and scientists, essentially.
Exactly. And a very concrete achievement was the reform of the Committee on World Food Security 2008. Here, we at La Via Campesina have not only advocated, but also actively participated in this democratization of, I would say, the United Nations. La Via Campesina has played a critical role in the reform of the United Nations food policy processes. As I said, 2008 with the World Food Crisis. So this space has been reformed and then opened up for the democratic participation of the civil society, but also from other sectors, no? And another example was, for example, the introduction of the FAO strategies for partnership with the civil society organizations and so on. So, I would say, yes, we have been participating in these spaces at global level, but also in different countries, there were processes at local or at national level where you can also see the inclusion of these actors in policy-making processes. It is different of what we are seeing today, but maybe this is, we can take it in the next question.
So just to make sure I understand that, I guess the United Nations is the highest level at which decisions about food and food systems are being made. And it used to be that you have this space being taken by, I guess, government officials and scientists and the sort of experts about food. But then since at least 1996, with the concept of food sovereignty, you had now this space opening up for some of these other actors who were not being allowed into that space. And they get to have a voice, sit at the table, bring in their own perspectives about this issue. And has it been working so far? Have there been gains made?
Maybe remaining in the example of the reform of the Committee on World Food Security and the creation of the civil society and the indigenous peoples mechanism, I would say that this reform brought new paradigms, no, and logics into this, these spaces, let's say, no, paving the way to the democratization of the global food system policy, no. And this was not only a progress, let's say, for the participation of civil society in general, but also leveled the field of play for national governments as well. No, yeah, and I would say that Via Campesina, together with the IPC, which is the International Planning Committee for Food Sovereignty, where several other food producers, constituencies, but also urban poor and consumers, we have been playing a vital role. And in terms of advancements, I would say that, first of all this work has been based on the principles of food sovereignty, no? With a comprehensive, transformative approach of the food system, trying to restore the health of our peoples and the nature. And I would say that there were several significant achievements and advancements. For example, the guidelines on land tenure, this is a CFS institutional language product, no, that is quite progressive. There was also the guidelines for securing sustainable small-scale fisheries. And I would say, also outside the CFS, there were other achievements that are extremely important. For example, the United Nations Declarations on the Rights of Peasants and Other People Working in Rural Areas, no, which is an extremely relevant instrument, first of all, to recognize us as right holders and defining what are our rights. This instrument is not necessarily creating new rights. What it is bringing together the rights defined in several other already existing instruments into a comprehensive human rights instrument.
So essentially, there has been a claiming of space. There has been some progress. But here at the State of Power podcast, we're concerned about power, right? About the people who are in power and what they do to maintain their power, which sometimes goes against these democratization processes, for instance, what you're describing. How do you phrase it, the establishment, the way things were beforehand, have they taken everything lying down? What have been the obstacles that have come your way?
Yeah, I would say that despite these major achievements that I just described and achievements that indeed posed, let's say, barriers, no, to the advancement of the corporate agenda, despite of this, I would say that the architects of the industrial agriculture, they have been constantly pushing for more destructive farming methods, aiming, of course, their own profits, no? Mm-hmm. And I would say that the COVID-19 pandemic has, for example, only reinforced and actually exposed the failure, on one hand, of the current dominant corporate food system to address problems like, for example, hunger, inequality, the ecological crisis, and so on. But on the other hand, the same COVID-19 pandemic has been globally used by these corporate actors to advance, no, the control of the big capital, let's say, no. And this they did while we of social movements, people really on the ground, no, grassroots-based movements, we were struggling to survive the pandemic, mm-hmm. no, the pandemic as such directly, but also survive its direct consequence, no? Uh-huh. And I would say that in normal situations, this capture that they were able to implement during the crisis, they would not have been able to do in a normal situation. But
Would you care to unpack or to explain a little bit of, or perhaps with an example, what you mean about this, that these corporate interests have used the pandemic to further their interests? Any particular item you can point to?
I mean, there are many examples. For example, the issue of local markets, no, peasant markets, no. The immediately when the pandemic broke out, peasants markets have been closed, although the majority of them take place outside, no, where the virus has more difficulty to contaminate, let's say, while supermarkets, the most of them are big supermarket chains, no, they remained open, no. Mm-hmm. This is an example where some corporations profited while peasants were facing.
So the small scale farmers couldn't even get that small part of the market share that they had fought so hard to get.
Exactly. This is an example. Another example is the outbreak in Europe was just before the springtime, where many agriculture farms, no, also bring cheap labor work, no, seasonal workers, mm-hmm. mainly from Eastern Europe. And although there were very strong hygienic measures, no, to block the pandemic, so people not being allowed, I mean, this whole lockdown and so on, the industry found ways through to get their workers here without respecting sanitary hygienic measures, no?
So regardless of all the government measures they put up, they still moved people between places to provide labor for their operations, essentially.
Exactly, and maybe it's also okay to move people, but taking into account the measures needed, yeah. no? On the other hand, you know, the borders in Europe were closed, but for agricultural workers, it was not closed, no? So there are interests behind it, no? Mm-hmm. So I think those are examples how the corporate food system was able to deal with policymakers in order mm-hmm. to achieve their interests, while we peasants were really facing enormous difficulties, no?
Everything was shut down and people couldn't sell.
Yeah, some of us, depending on the region where people were based, no, their farm plots are not necessarily directly where they live, no. Mm-hmm. So some of us could not even reach their fields. For example, for pastoralists, no, the Eastern holidays events where they sell quite a lot of their lambs, no, mm-hmm. And it was just before Easter, no, and they were not allowed to sell. So it means that annual income from some food producers was completely shut down with the COVID measures that were put in place, no, while the industry was allowed to remain selling, and selling probably even much more because the local markets were shut down.
This is something that we've seen really happen across the globe, that you've seen corporate interests gain a lot of the market share they'd lost to maybe some local initiatives, and how governments have been much more sensitive to the needs of corporate players, of these big industrial players, at the expense of small-scale fisher people. For instance, in Indonesia, we had a conversation with a representative of some of the fisher peoples there. And elsewhere in the world, in South Africa, for instance, as well, you had the same situation where the spaza shops and the small-scale traders couldn't operate, but the big supermarkets were able to remain open. It's quite frustrating when you think about it. But what do we do about it then? How do we proceed?
From our point of view, as Via Campesina, in order to achieve a real food system transformation, how we need, there are several aspects to be considered, and I could name here some of them. For example, as I already mentioned, the local markets, they need to be strengthened, they need to be built and developed where they are no longer existing. So local markets that are diverse, that are agroecological, built by the people on the ground, instead of remarking and expanding this corporate-based globalized food system as we just spoke about, And for that to succeed, we need also, for example, to conduct genuine agrarian reform in many countries, in many territories still. We need also to support the use and also the dissemination of peasant seeds and so on. Another aspect is, for example, regarding the climate. The industrialized agriculture and the industrialized corporate food system, they play an extremely big role in the increasing of the climate crisis. The levels of greenhouse gas emissions are enormous here. So if we want to truly tackle the climate crisis, it is extremely important to take agriculture into account and to make a shift from industrialized agriculture and also this globalized food system to local food systems based on peasant agriculture through agroecological methods.
What did you say to people who say, well, society developed from a peasant agriculture and there's a reason why we came up with industrial agriculture? Because the modern world requires higher levels of output and all of that. What would be your response to this?
Yeah, I think the industrialization, technologization of agriculture, it is a process that we have strongly seen in the second half of the 20th century. It's a process called the Green Revolution, a revolution that is not green at all. It's only a greenwashing. And it is part of this process of industrialization and modernization of, I would say, not only from the food system, but the food system and agriculture faced it quite rapidly. Also the use of chemicals and so on. It's also a consequence or a result out of, chemicals and nuclear experiments used also during the Second World War. And this increasing of corporate power, let's say, in the whole globalized world. So it's not a natural process, but it is obvious that also agriculture is a sector area which they would not leave untouched. And what we are seeing nowadays is a step forward, towards digitalization, robotization, and so on. And at some point where maybe non-human force will not be used anymore in agriculture,
So there won't even be work for the few people that are still involved in the agricultural sector.
Exactly, but also the consequence, there are many consequences of this, It's not only that we are losing labor need in agriculture, but also our dieties are really decreasing in nutrition values and so on. The whole climate crisis we already spoke about, because it's everything based on, let's say, fossil fuel energy or other source of energy and patternization of food and so on. So there are many, many, many problems here. And who pay the bill in the end are the people.
Mm. It's the people in the end. Mm. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned also agrarian reform and the need to make available seeds and all of that, because I think that's something that usually falls through the cracks in this conversation, even just in my own lifetime, thinking of life in Zimbabwe, where people would just keep their own seeds for the next planting season. But now you have to go and buy your seeds from the seed co because the plants won't grow again. It's been quite a big change. But okay, so now let's talk about...
Only you are losing your seed, you are also losing the sovereignty about your about the variety, you know, of
precisely
food. You are losing your whole culinary traditions, no? Yeah. Because the seeds that are accessible are, as I said, standardized seeds that you can find everywhere in the world. And you have to use, let's say, pesticides and other chemicals to...
For it to grow.
Exactly. Yeah. So this has also this, let's say, climate consequences, no? But also consequence to direct health of the people using these pesticides, no? So increase
the health of the land as well, because it gets into the water.
And exactly, no? So there are so many bad consequences here. And who is profiting? Only the corporations.
Mm. Yeah. Well, so now... So, for instance, right now, in the coming months, you've got the United Nations Food System Summit coming up. The United Nations is like, I guess, as you mentioned, it's the big space where these decisions are made, right? What's your feeling about this summit? Is it like an opportunity to change some of these things we're talking about?
So from our point of view as Via Campesina, there is no doubt that it is extremely urgent to have a global conversation around food systems, no? Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, we are extremely alarmed about the upcoming United Nations Food System Summit 2021. And there are several reasons for that, no? Mm-hmm. We are very clear that this summit and its process, its contents, no, and so on, they will not achieve it. They, in theory, know what they say, they describe, their aims are to address exactly what we are talking about, no? The needed transformations within our food systems, no?
Yeah.
But so far, since its announcement 2019, we have been closely following all the process, no? Mm-hmm. And we are very clear that the whole process and content of the summit, the actors involved are all moving in the completely wrong direction. And we see that this summit actually is a clear example on how corporate capture is in overdrive, using, for example, even the COVID-19 pandemic and the increase of food insecurity nowadays to push for their profit-driven interests, no?
So the summit is heavily influenced by corporations. How are they influencing what's going on? I thought the United Nations would be like a sort of space for governments and all of that.
Yeah, it should be. But it's important to say that this summit is, let's say, a clear and direct result of a partnership agreement signed in, I think it was July 2019, between the United Nations and Secretary General and the World Economic Forum. The World Economic Forum is a private sector organization representing actually the 1,000 largest corporations in the world. And also, shortly after the signature of signing this agreement, the summit has been announced. No, I would say that the summit, the process so far, has been clearly opening the doors of the United Nations system to the private sector. No, this is what we have been observing so far. No, and for example, they have been claiming their inclusivity, you know, through a multi-stakeholder approach, the most inclusive space than ever before. But all this is a pure facade from our point of view, because this is not considered the unbalance of power between the various existing stakeholders, let's say, you know, and it is instead privileging the corporate elites, you know. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, the process has been very opaque, exclusive, and has ignored any principle of autonomy of people's movements. Instead of that, they have been opting for handpicking participants. And we have been denouncing this since 2019. There was a first letter that we sent, and no big change have happened so far. And so it's clear for us that this process and the intentions behind this summit were very, very clear from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's safe to say that the UNFSS will likely not serve the interests of these people that you've mentioned, the actors who have actually worked so hard to carve a space in this decision-making space and are now somewhat sidelined out of it again.
Yeah, we are clearly being sidelined, although, as I said, they are using a very inclusive language, but in reality, there is no clarity on who is taking decisions. There is no clarity who will be accountable. There is no clarity what will be the real outcomes, where it will go to. There are so many things that are not clarified that, for example, we as Via Campesina have been very clear that we cannot legitimize a process like this. The rules need to be defined in advance. Otherwise, we cannot cope with such a kind of process.
So what are some of the activities that are going around to counter this that's going on at the UNFSS?
Yeah, so Via Campesina, because we are very clear that this summit is not going into the right direction, its process and also its content, its solutions that are being put on the table, they are absolutely not going the right direction. Therefore, we are very clear that we will not be part of this show. We are instead joining forces with other members of the civil society to actually organize a counter summit between the 25th and 28th of July 2021, where we want to present our real alternatives. Actually, they are not alternatives. They are actually on the only way forward, let's say, mm-hmm. And solutions that actually emerge from our concrete experiences in our territories. Join us in those mobilizations. You can find more information in the website Food Systems for People. There will be a lot of information and the program of the counter summit, let's say, and as Via Campesina, we are very, very clear in boycotting this because we don't want to have this space legitimized through our presence.
Uh-huh. So now looking at time with our conversation coming to a close, what are the alternatives that are available for these actors that you've pointed out who feel sidelined in this, what seems to be a major decision-making space, what seems to be a major agenda-setting space, and what is it that's being done by these actors to counter some of these developments?
In order to achieve the future that we really want, we urgently need to better link the food sovereignty right, which has been recognized as a right in several instruments, from the United Nations. Some of them I have already named here, So we need to link this food sovereignty right with the implementation of the rights anchored, for example, in the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Peasants and Other People Working in Rural Areas, Mm-hmm. And as I said, this year we are celebrating 25 years of food sovereignty. And mm-hmm. For the next 25 years, it is important that we strengthen the localized food systems, which are mm-hmm. critical in the fight against hunger, also in order to cool the planet, in order to preserve biodiversity, respecting peasants and also workers' rights and so on, no? Mm-hmm. And for example, the COVID-19 pandemic has shown us the importance and also the resilience of local food systems that have actually kept, although we had so many constraints, we have still been able to kept many people from hunger and starvation. So in that sense, as Via Campesina, and I'm sure also allied social movements and other civil society organizations, will continue to push for a radical transformation or a radical transformative strategy towards a fair and decent food system for all, a food system that recognizes people's needs, a food system that goes hand in hand with dignity, and a food system that respects nature, which puts people above profits, and finally, a food system that will remain resisting against corporate capture. No, right now it's the time, no, to transform and to build our societies in a much better direction, anchored on food sovereignty and taking human rights into account.
Thank you so much, Paola. Such a great way to end this conversation.
Thanks very much for giving us.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast by the Transnational Institute. And this has been a conversation with Paola Gioia, a peasant farmer living in Germany, who's part of the European coordination of La Via Campesina. To find out more about the content of our conversation, please visit www.foodsystemsforpeople.org, with the 4 spelt as that number 4. That is www.foodsystemsforpeople.org with the 4 spelt as the number 4. Please check the podcast description for this and other relevant links. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.